Hello, and welcome to D&T Book Club. My name is Megan, and today we will be finishing our discussion of Dragons of Summer Flame by Margaret Weis and Tracy Hickman. We will be picking up the story where we left off last time, so if you haven't listened to episode 8.1 already, I suggest you stop now and listen to that first. After we finish discussing the story, we will discuss the novel as a whole, what works and what doesn't, and do some character studies as well. As usual, this episode will contain spoilers, so if you prefer to read the novel before listening to the episode, listen no further. If you'd like to support the podcast and get access to bonus episodes, please visit patreon.com/dandbookclub. That's D-A-N-D-D Book Club. For $5 a month, you'll be helping the show to remain ad-free, and you'll get exclusive content as well. You can view the bonus episodes available without any commitment by visiting patreon.com/dndbookclub. To send me a question or a comment, you can email me at dndbookclub@gmail.com or follow me on Instagram at dndbookclub. Now, with no further delay, let's dive into part two of Dragons of Summer Flame. Palin Majeure has just returned to Kryn, along with his uncle Rayson Majeure and their companion Tasselhoff Burfoot, to find a world greatly changed. A month has passed on the material plane while he was on his day trip to the Abyss. In that time, the Knights of Tachesis have conquered more of Ancelon than the dragon armies were able to conquer during the entire War of the Lance. Palin and his friends know the victory of the Dark Knights was orchestrated by the gods themselves to ensure that Ancelon would be unified in time to organize an effective defense against the Elder God Chaos and his minions. All the people of Ancelon know, however, is that they are now living in occupied territory. The Knights are not especially cruel or violent rulers, but the people have been deprived of freedom nonetheless, and many would rather die than live under such conditions. While Tasselhoff remains behind in Palanthas, Palin and Raistlin travel to their hometown of Solas. At the Inn of the Last Home, Raistlin is reunited with his twin brother Caramon Majeure, after Caramon believed him dead for decades. The two brothers have a heart-to-heart talk, trying to put the past behind them. Raistlin also learns that his room at the inn has become something of a shrine, and that passing wizards often leave magical items as a kind of offering to his memory. Raistlin has been stripped of his magic. That was the price for his return to Kryn, so these magical items will be quite useful. Raistlin has definitely changed since the events of the Legends trilogy. He's still kind of a condescending jerk, but he's softened in his attitude and he appears to feel genuine remorse for the evil he committed, even going so far as to visit Lady Corsania later in the novel to make amends. During his test of high sorcery, Rayson Majeure was inhabited by the parasitic spirit of the evil wizard Fistan Dantalus, and that event is often seen as what triggered Rayson's eventual descent into darkness. In the Legends trilogy, the authors make it very unclear where Rayson ends and Fistan Dantalus begins, allowing for open-ended questions about the nature of evil and free will. With Rayson's return, however, it seems that Rayson's sacrifice to save Kryn purged the spirit of Fistan Dantalus from his soul, and that Raistlin has returned to the person he was before his test of high sorcery. That is to say, he's not a nice person, but he's not evil either. He's gone from chaotic evil to lawful neutral. Raistlin has a plan for how to proceed with warning the world about the threat of chaos. Palin will return to Palanthas by magical means this time to confer with Dalimar and Mistress Jenna there. Meanwhile, Caramon will escort Raistlin to the Tower of High Sorcery in Weyrith Forest so that Raistlin can address the wizards there personally. Palin departs, and the twins begin their journey. Along the way, Raistlin and Caramon are accosted by Knights of the Thorn, who are attempting to infiltrate Weyrith Forest without much success. Using makeup and some sleight-of-hand tricks, Raistlin convinces the Grey Robes, led by our friend the Night Lord Lilith, that he has been sent by the Dark Queen back to Kryn as a lich. He has been sent, he claims, to deliver a warning to Lord Arioch'an that grave danger is coming from the north and to be prepared to fight it. Then he vanishes in a puff of smoke. Once the knights leave, Rhaesyn climbs out of a tree hollow where he was hiding, and the two brothers continue onward. After speaking to the wizards at the Tower of High Sorcery in Weyrith, and taking one item of particular power and value for himself, Rhaesyn makes another journey. He travels to the city of Palanthus to meet Usha, the woman claiming to be his daughter. Palin told Rhaesyn all about Usha, with whom the young man was clearly infatuated. Rhaesyn scoffs at the idea until Palin related the legend of how Rhaesyn might have had a daughter and then had his memory erased. Rhaesyn doesn't know whether the child is his, so he does a little investigating of his own, Maury Povich style, then seeks out Usha in person. He finds Usha working for the Thieves Guild in Palanthus, where she is receiving free room and board as well as training, thanks to the dubious patronage of Dugan Redhammer. Rhaesyn then tells Usha the truth about her heritage. Her parents were traveling on a ship at sea, were captured by pirates and escaped overboard, only to wash up on the Irta Island. There, Usha's mother gave birth to her, a daughter with golden eyes like her own. The Irta refused to let the human couple leave, so the humans made an escape attempt. During the attempt, her parents were quote-unquote accidentally killed, and Usha was the sole survivor to be raised among the Irta. The resemblance between Rhaesyn and Usha is purely a coincidence. Nevertheless, Rhaesyn feels a certain affection for this young woman, as if he might have wished the legend were true. The most important takeaway from all of this is that Palin and Usha are not, in fact, first cousins. Palin arrives in Palanthus and heads first to Mistress Jenna's mageware shop. The shop is still open for business despite the occupation, although a Knight of the Thorn has been assigned to the shop to screen all customers. There is a warrant out for Palin's arrest, although he's unaware of it, and the Thorn Knight is immediately suspicious of this white-robed wizard. Jenna is able to trick the knight into believing Palin is one of her regular students. Once they are in private, Jenna tells Palin that he must go with her agent to find a person she's been trying to track, then meet Rhaesyn at the Great Library in Palanthus. Her agent happens to be Tasselhoff, who has located the missing person. Spoiler alert, it's Usha. Palin and Tasselhoff proceed to a tavern called the Goose and Gander, where Usha is working as a waitress. Dugan Redhammer also shows up at the tavern, to Palin's chagrin. As often happens in seedy taverns, a brawl breaks out. Amidst the disorder of tables being overturned, bottles being broken against heads, and men being thrown through safety glass windows out onto the street, Palin, Usha, and Tasselhoff flee while Dugan covers their retreat. The trio cannot be caught out in the open by patrolling knights, or Palin will be arrested. They escape into the sewer and make their way towards the Great Library. The three arrive at the Great Library covered in sewer slime, and the head monk refuses to let them see the historian Asinus without changing clothes first. Palin is escorted to her private room to change, but, to his surprise, the robes he's been offered are black, not white. Rhaesyn shows up at last, and Asinus explains that Palin is being offered the black robes because he has committed an act of true evil. Palin has no idea what the historian is talking about. Take it from a history major, people rarely have any idea what a historian is talking about, until Palin realizes that Steel Brightblade is going to be executed in his place. According to the knighthood's law, Steel took Palin's death sentence upon himself when he lost Palin as his prisoner. Palin has two options. He can let his cousin Steel die, take the black robes, receive the powerful spell books of Fistan Dantalus, which Rhaesyn still possesses, and live happily ever after with Usha. Or he can travel to the High Clarice Tower and take Steel's place and die. Palin makes his choice and puts back on his wet sewer robes, writes a love letter to Usha, whom he hasn't yet been told isn't his cousin, but I guess it hardly matters at this point, and teleports away with a magic ring. Steel, meanwhile, is preparing to face his death with honor and dignity, which is pretty much how Steel does everything, whether it's using the restroom or being beheaded. He is brought to the block and calmly rests his head on the blood-stained stone. Lord Arioch'an, who is Steel's sponsor and thus must act as his executioner, prepares to kill Steel with the Brightblade family sword. At the last possible moment, Palin appears and interposes himself between Steel and Arioch'an. Now we get the kind of scene that every fantasy reader loves. Legalistic arguments about fictional law. According to Subcommander Trevelyan, Steele's commanding officer, Palin's return nullifies Steele's death sentence. They can cut off Palin's head and put this unpleasantness behind them. The Night Lord, however, argues that since Steele didn't recapture Palin, they should both be executed. Lord Arriakyn gives Palin a chance to speak. Palin apologizes to Steele, then tells the story of his time in the Abyss, including what he learned about the return of Chaos. Lord Arriakyn needs time to think all this over, so he orders Steele to return to his unit and orders Palin imprisoned. Before Palin can be imprisoned, however, the Night Lord makes one more attempt to take the staff of Magius from him. To everyone's surprise, she succeeds. Back in Palanthus, Usha and Tasselhoff discover that Palin has gone and discover his incestuous love note. The two decide to rescue Palin from the Knights. Usha puts on the black robes that Palin had refused in order to disguise herself as an evil cleric. Using one of the magical artifacts the Irida gave her, Usha whisks herself and Tass away to the tower. Their plan goes awry immediately, however. Steele has gone to visit Palin in his cell, and he of course recognizes Usha and Tasselhoff. The Night Lord, who has been suspecting some kind of rescue attempt, suddenly appears with Lord Arriakyn and accuses Steele of attempting to free Palin. Lord Arriakyn once again sentences Steele to death. Usha uses an Irida crystal to freeze all of the knights except Steele in place. Nevertheless, Steele still attempts to arrest them. He simply cannot stop being a knight, even if it means being executed for something he didn't do. Suddenly, the entire tower shakes as if lightning has struck with explosive force. Usha drops the Irida crystal and the knights are free again. The shaking also causes the Night Lord to lose her balance and trip over the staff of Magius, which she's holding. No one tries to catch her because, well, no one likes her. She falls to the floor just in time to be impaled by the iron spikes of a falling portcullis. Just then, a messenger arrives to inform Lord Arriakyn that the tower appears to be under attack by lightning and fire. Lord Arriakyn correctly deduces that, if Palin's story is true, then this may be Chaos's opening salvo. After Arriakyn leaves, Raistlin appears, prepared to magic Palin, Usha, and Tass back to Palanthus. Steele refuses to let them leave until Raistlin tells him a story about his time with Steele's father. Steele is moved to tears by the story and finally allows his prisoners to leave. Raistlin, Palin, Usha, and Tass meet with Dalimar at the Tower of High Sorcery in Palanthus to plan their next move. Palin, Usha, and Tass will travel to the Irida Island in Usha's boat in order to retrieve the broken pieces of the Grey Gem. Once they arrive on the island, Usha is devastated to find all of her people dead. Moving inland, they encounter Dugan Redhammer, who is likewise on a mission to retrieve the pieces of the Grey Gem. The grove in which the gem is hidden, however, is being guarded by minions of Chaos called Shadow Wights. They are kind of like ghosts, but instead of being composed of the soul of a dead person, they are composed of nothingness. Chaos has literally made something out of nothing. Tasselhoff attempts to enter the grove, only to be stopped by the Whites. Palin attempts to help him, but is frozen in terror by the Whites' influence. It's up to Usha, using her Thieves Guild training, to sneak past the Whites and recover the pieces of the Grey Gem, which she then uses to banish the creatures and rescue her companions. With the Shadow Whites gone and the Grey Gem recovered, Raistlin appears, as he likes to do after all the excitement is over. He gives Palin the legendary spellbook of Magius, telling him that the spells in there are powerful enough to be used against Chaos himself, although Palin doubts he is strong enough to cast them. Now Palin must travel to the Abyss along with Usha and Tass to confront Chaos, although others will join to help them. Dugan explains that if they can catch a drop of blood from Chaos in the Grey Gem, they will be able to trap him once again. Of course, this is easier said than done. Back at the High Cleric's Tower, after the initial attack of Chaos's forces against the Knights of Tachesis, Lord Arriakyn is visited by Queen Tachesis herself. She explains that only weapons blessed by her clerics have the power to harm the Shadow Whites who will lead the attack. She also warns that any person touched by one of these Shadow Whites will become nothing, and not even a memory of them will remain. She also instructs Arriakyn to hold a special unit in reserve. She believes that, once Chaos is defeated, this special unit will be able to seize control over whatever remains on Ancelon. As it happens, Steel is among the knights chosen to be part of this elite squad, although he and his comrades have no idea why they're being asked to sit out the battle. They must hide in the depths of the tower while the battle rages on overhead, knights fighting shadow whites, good and evil dragons uniting together against Chaos's fire dragons. The knights sit and wait and listen to the sounds of battle until, eventually, the sounds cease. Steel and his men leave their hiding place to discover that every single defender of the tower has been killed, human and dragon alike, including Lord Ariakin. That night, Steel is visited by the apparition of his mother, Dragon High Lord Kitiara Uthmatar. She tells Steel that the battle for Kryn has been lost and that Takisa's plans to flee this plane of existence while she still can and create a new world. Kitiara has been invited to join the Dark Queen. So has Steel. It is only now that Steel sees the truth. The Dark Queen did not care about her knights. They were just tools to her, and now that they have failed, she will abandon them. Steel refuses to go with his mother. He is shaken to his very core. All the purpose in his life has vanished in an instant. Then another apparition appears, that of his father, Sturm Brightblade, Knight of Salamnia. Sturm tells his son that the battle is not over yet, that others fight on, and it might yet be won. Steel must take his knights and confront Chaos, knowing they will die, knowing their deaths may change nothing. Steel and his company decide to join the battle against Chaos, riding the blue dragons that were held in reserve before the battle, as they were. The Dark Knights discover that the Knights of Salamnia, who have been held prisoner since the Knights of Takisus took the tower, have managed to survive the battle as well. They agree to join Steel and his knights, riding silver dragons who have since arrived. Just before they can set out, Steel's blue dragon Flare appears. She has been investigating reports of a rift in the turbidous ocean leading into the abyss itself. This is where the knights will go to join the gods themselves in battle against Chaos. The Dark Knights take flight on their blue dragons. The Knights of Salamnia follow on their silvers, carrying into battle the last remaining dragon lances. When Steel enters the abyss, he finds Palin waiting for him. Palin explains that he has to accompany Steel into battle so he can use a powerful spell from the spellbook of Magius to distract Chaos long enough for the knights to wound him so that Chaos's blood can be collected in the Grey Gem by Usha below. Flare thinks this is ridiculous, but Steel takes Palin along with them anyway. They need to hurry. Chaos has sent most of his minions to Ancelon to attack, leaving only a minimal amount of defenders for himself. They need to strike before he can call in reinforcements. Meanwhile, Dugan Redhammer has used his power to transport Usha, Tasselhoff, and the Grove of Trees containing the Altar of the Grey Gem into the Abyss. Chaos has grown now to the size of a mountain, so he's not hard to find. He knows what Dugan intends and mocks the puny god. In retaliation, Tasselhoff mocks Chaos right back. Chaos may be a world-devouring monster, but no one can dish out insults like a Kender. Chaos becomes more and more enraged, but it's all a trick. Tasselhoff is trying to distract him so Steel and the other knights can get in close. The plan works. Chaos is caught off guard. Flare lands briefly to drop Palin off on the ground before flying into battle. The Knights of Salamnia use the dragon lances to battle against the fire dragons of Chaos. The Knights of Takisus battle demon warriors. Chaos and his minions are momentarily on the defensive, but the heroes don't have much time. Palin struggles to cast the spell he has prepared, but his concentration falters. At last, Palin summons all his inner reserves of strength and speaks the words of the spell. The staff of Magius begins to glow with an intense magical light that destroys the demon warriors and shadow whites and scatters the fire dragons, leaving them vulnerable. At last, Chaos looks down to see what all the fuss is about and is blinded by a beam of pure white light. With Chaos blinded and in agonizing pain, Steel flies Flare in close. The intense heat around the giant scorches both of them, but they press their attack. Flare flies in as close as possible, and Steel stabs at Chaos's exposed shoulder with his father's sword. Usha moves in close, preparing to catch the drop of blood in the Grey Gem. Steel and Flare fly close again, and Steel yanks his sword from Chaos's flesh, causing a single drop of blood to fall to the ground. Enraged, Chaos knocks the dragon and her rider from the sky. Palin is knocked to the ground, and his spell is broken. Usha fails to catch the drop of blood. Palin goes to Usha just as Chaos prepares to crush them both beneath his boot. Tasselhoff, seeing his friends are about to be killed, rushes in and stabs Chaos in the toe with his dagger. Chaos jerks his foot back for a moment, blood dripping out from his wound, then crushes Tasselhoff beneath his boot, killing him. But a drop of blood from Tasselhoff's stab has landed in one of the broken halves of the Grey Gem. Usha closes the halves together and everything vanishes around her, leaving her holding the gem in total darkness. Chaos has been trapped once again. The Grey Gem rises from her hands, rises into the darkness, and explodes. The pieces of the Grey Gem become new stars in the night sky, replacing the familiar constellations of the gods of Kryn. A new white moon rises. The red, silver, and black moons of the gods of magic are gone. By the light of the white moon, Usha finds Palin and collapses. When Palin awakens, he is laying in a field in his hometown of Solace with Usha beside him. A gentle rain is falling. Looking around, Usha and Palin see the bodies of the Knights of Tachesis and the Knights of Salamia all around them. Only Steel survives, and just barely. The two cousins share a final farewell before Steel dies, holding his sword. His last words are the creed his father lived and died by. My honor is my life. Palin manages to recover the staff of Magius, but immediately knows something is wrong. The staff feels strangely inert, not alive with magical power. Raistlin appears, telling Palin that he plans to return to his sleep. Just then, someone else appears. It's Fizban the Fabulous, the elderly white-robed wizard, the avatar of the god Paladine. Fizban explains that Chaos has been banished from Kryn, but that all the gods must now depart lest Chaos return one day. With the departure of the gods, so too will come the disappearance of magic. That's why the staff felt so lifeless to Palin. Fizban tells Palin that this will be the beginning of a new age, the Age of Mortals. Before leaving to join the other gods, Fizban invites Raistlin to come along with them to help with the creation of this new world. Raistlin Majeer will become a god after all. In that very field, a tomb is built where the Knights of Tachesis and the Knights of Salamia who died in the last battle will be buried side by side, as well as the body of Tanis Half-Elven. And a memorial is carved in honor of Kryn's greatest hero, Tasselhoff Barefoot, now reunited with the old dwarf Flint Fireforge at long last. Okay, so that was Dragons of Summer Flame. Now I want to take some time to talk about what I like about the novel and what I don't. Right off the bat, I'll say that this is a dense book, especially for a pulp fantasy novel. There really isn't a wasted page. I've heard a rumor that Dragons of Summer Flame was originally intended to be another trilogy, a Second Chronicles trilogy all about the Chaos War instead of the War of the Lance, perhaps. I don't know if this rumor is true, but it would explain why this book has so much packed into it. In fact, I was talking to another Dragonlance fan online recently who complained that Dragons of Summer Flame felt, in his words, rushed, as if it should have been a trilogy instead of a single novel. If you enjoyed this novel and you're interested in what the trilogy might have been like, there is a series of novels called the Chaos War series, which consists of 6 novels whose stories are taking place simultaneously to Dragons of Summer Flame on other parts of the continent. There's The Puppet King about the elves, The Last Thane about the dwarves, Tears of the Night Sky about Lady Corsania, Reavers of the Blood Sea about the Minotaur, The Siege of Mount Nevermind about the gnomes, and even a novel by Margaret Weis herself called The Doom Brigade, about a renegade group of draconians trying to start their own independent society. Side note, I'll likely cover The Puppet King and definitely The Doom Brigade as bonus episodes in the future. Maybe Margaret Weis and Tracy Hickman simply decided there wasn't enough material to do justice to the story they wanted to tell in a trilogy format, although it's interesting that the novel does kind of follow a 3-act structure. Act 1 is Usha coming to Anslan, as well as Palin and Steele's adventure together. Act 2 is Palin in the Abyss, Usha training as a thief, and the Dark Knight's invasion of Anslan. And then Act 3 is the battle against Chaos himself. I think that it could have worked, although the density of the story in a single novel is one of its unique charms. If you've listened to this podcast long enough, you've probably heard me talk about pacing more than once. I tend to favor novels which move along at a brisk pace from scene to scene to scene. Every chapter should always be focused on either story, plot, or character development, or some combination of the three, building a strong narrative. If you want an example of novels with terrible pacing, try reading the middle novels of the Wheel of Time series or the later Dune novels. They can truly be a slog, and that's coming from a devoted fan of both. Dragons of Summer Flame, much like the OG Dragons of Autumn Twilight, kicks into gear within a chapter or two and doesn't let up until the end. Something happens in almost every chapter to move the story along, and a few scenes that don't, like Caramon and Raistlin's little mini-adventure to the Tower of Weyreth, provide some enjoyable character moments or foreshadowing to later events. There's a scene about midway through of Steele as a prisoner refusing to allow a Salamnic knight to be beaten for something that Steele had done. This scene doesn't advance the story, but it does set up the alliance of the Knights of T'Kesis and the Knights of Salamnia for the final battle. The Salamnics know that Steele is an honorable man and are thus willing to follow him into battle. The most difficult part of this episode was to write the section between Steele's execution and the last battle against Chaos. When I write an episode, I try to strip the story down to its most essential plot points, since you might as well just read the novel otherwise. But so much happens in such a short span of time in the final sequence that it was difficult to include it all without feeling like I was writing a Reader's Digest abridged version. Constructing a novel is like building a Jenga tower. You can build it very tall using as few pieces as possible, like the Wheel of Time, or you can build it short but sturdy, like The Hobbit. Dragons of Summer Flame is tall and sturdy, and it was tough for me to decide which pieces to pull out and discuss. I only hope I could do it justice. Of course, I love the characters as well. I think the strength of Margaret Weis and Tracy Hickman's characters is really what separates Dragonlance from other more action-driven D&D novels. We'll start with Palin Majeure. Now, Palin had been around for a while as a concept before Dragons of Summer Flame was written. He first appeared in the Tales trilogy, along with his brothers Tannen and Sturm, in 1987, and Dragons of Summer Flame wasn't written until 8 years later, so Palin had existed within the Dragonlance extended universe already. He's the protagonist in The Legacy and kind of hogs the spotlight in Wanna Bet, but this is his first appearance in a novel. I remember reading this book the first time and being shocked that Tannen and Sturm, who you'd assume would be major characters in this novel after reading the second generation, die off camera before the story even begins. I think it works in the novel's favor, though. Palin's guilt over the loss of his brothers is what provides his motivation as well as some tension, as Palin struggles to avoid the temptation of taking the easy road to power by donning the black robes. A happy and emotionally stable Palin wouldn't have made quite as compelling a hero. Also, Tannen and Sturm were boring characters who likely would have not contributed anything anyway. Plus, they were Knights of Salamnia, and the authors clearly wanted to focus on Steele and the Knights of T'Kesis rather than walking that well-trodden ground. Or maybe it was as simple as not wanting to create confusion between Sturm Majeure and Sturm Brightblade. I have to say, as a side note, that I find Palin's relationship with Usha slightly hilarious. When he first meets her, he's instantly smitten and seems to experience physical pain when he finds out that she's his cousin, or so he thinks. But that really doesn't change the way he feels about her. There's even a scene at the end of The Last Home when Caramon learns that Palin is in love with a woman claiming to be Raistlin's daughter and gives his son a weird look. Palin confesses his love for Usha before he finds out that they aren't really cousins. I probably shouldn't say this, but I kind of respect Palin for that. He's in love with his cousin, and he owns it. It's hard for me to choose a favorite Palin moment. It might be the scene when Palin rescues Steele in an attempt to trade his life for Steele's. It's the kind of hero moment you expect from the son of Caramon Majeure and Teeka Wayland. Lots of heroes in fantasy novels are willing to sacrifice their lives in war or to save the world, but Palin is willing to sacrifice his life to save one man, a man sworn to evil at that, simply because it's the right thing to do. That takes a rare kind of courage. My other favorite moment must be the casting of the light spell to blind Chaos. You really need to read the book to capture the power of the scene, but Palin can't cast a spell until he's overcome everything holding him back, and it's a triumphant moment when he does. Now I want to talk about my favorite character in the novel, one of my favorite characters in all of Dragonlance, Steel Brightblade. Steel is one of my favorite characters because he's so complicated and nuanced and, for lack of a better word, deep. He's exactly the kind of dark and brooding anti-hero with a good heart underneath that we all loved in the mid-90s, and I guess I've never quite gotten over it. Steel is a complex person from the moment he's born. D&D novels love to use the trope of great heroes being born innately good or great villains being born innately evil, with the bulk of humanity falling somewhere in the middle. But Steel is the rare character who was born with both light and dark, in equal measure, directly opposed to one another. And he's the heir of two legacies which no one could ever live up to. His father was one of the most famous and virtuous knights of good that has ever lived, and his mother was one of the most infamous and ruthless warriors of evil who has ever lived, and she killed him. That would leave anyone in desperate need of therapy. I don't swear on this podcast, but Steel had an effed up childhood. His mother essentially abandoned him at birth to be raised by a stranger with no knowledge of who his real father was. The other children he grew up with, bland spawn of bland parents, didn't want to hang out with this weird kid who didn't think or talk or act like a normal child. As someone who also grew up not thinking or talking or acting like a normal child, I can relate. There's an intensity to Steel which isolates him from his peers. Maybe it's Kitiara's dark streak. Maybe it's his father's insufferable seriousness. They both seem to manifest in Steel in different ways at different times. So of course the Knights of Tachesis seem like a godsend, or a goddess send, I guess. The knighthood gives Steel an outlet for both aspects of his dual nature. He is rewarded for being an honest, brave, and loyal person, as well as a skilled fighter, but he also gets to wear cool black armor, and he doesn't have to have a silly mustache like the Knights of Salamnia. The knighthood seems like the perfect place for Steel, but even among the knights, he's something of an outsider. For comparison, let's look at Lord Ariokin. He wants to conquer all of Ancelon in the name of the Dark Queen, and he sees following a code of honor, as the Knights of Salamnia do, as the most effective way to guarantee that victory. Ariokin isn't motivated by an innate sense of honor. None of the Knights of Tachesis are. They use honor like a weapon, no different than a sword or a shield. Tachesis understands this. That's why she felt no qualms about abandoning the knights to save herself. But honor isn't something to be picked up or discarded as necessary for Steel Brightblade. Honor is a part of the fabric of his soul. Steel's story in Dragons of Summer Flame is the story of a man at war with himself. Steel's inner conflict is manifested in a kind of death wish. Palin even remarks on it later in the novel. Despite his stoic exterior, Steel's soul is in turmoil, and he would rather die than face himself. That's why he asks early on to be moved from his position as Ariokin's aide-de-camp to a fighting unit. That's why he accepts risky assignments and ransoms his own life. That's why he's thrilled to lead the first assault on the High Clarice Tower. And that's why he allows himself to be led to the executioner's block without a word of protest. My favorite scene with Steel in the novel is when Raistlin tells Steel about his father, Sturm. I'll read an excerpt for you. Raistlin strode forward, black robes whispering across the stone floor. Steel eyed him warily, drew his sword. "I recognize that blade," Raistlin said calmly. "Your father's, isn't it? I never liked your father much. All that business about knightly honor, nobility, he made such a show of it. Flaunted it, threw it in my face." Steel said nothing, but his hand gripped the sword's hilt more tightly until the knuckles turned white. Raistlin drew closer still. "And then I discovered something very interesting about your father. He lied to us. Sturm Brightblade was no more a knight than I was. He was made a knight only very shortly before his death. All that time he wore the armor, carried the sword, and it was all a lie." Raistlin shrugged. "And you know what? I liked him better after I learned that. Your father lied to every person except one, himself. In his heart, Sturm was a knight. He had better claim to that false title than any who held it for truth. Sturm Brightblade obeyed laws that no one enforced. He lived by a noble code in which no one else believed. He swore an oath that no one heard. No one would have held him to that oath. He did that himself. He knew himself. Who are you, Steel Brightblade? Do you know? Steel's face drained of color. His mouth opened, but no words passed his lips. A tear slid down his cheek. He lowered his head so swiftly that the long black hair tumbled down in front of his face. With an angry motion, he thrust his sword into its sheath. Turning, not looking at any of them, he ran toward the stairs and the sounds of battle. But his struggle isn't purely internal. Little by little, Steel loses the foundation on which he has built his entire identity. He truly believes in the mission of the knighthood at the outset, but his faith is ultimately shaken. First, he loses faith in himself when he hesitates at the threshold to the door to Raceland's laboratory, blaming his failure to keep Palin captive on his own cowardice. Then, he loses faith in the knighthood when he begins to realize that the knighthood is plagued by infighting and that Lord Ariokan's system of justice is cruel and rigid and arbitrary. Finally, he loses faith in Takisis herself when he chooses to remain behind to protect the world she is abandoning. Ultimately, his faith in his comrades and in his friends is what sustains him and gives him the strength to fight chaos. When Steel dies, he doesn't die as a knight of evil with a death wish. He dies as an honorable man. I have one final thought about Steel. I think Steel is gay. This isn't canon or anything, and I can't make a well-reasoned, well-substantiated argument. But there's one scene that convinced me. It's the scene in the Tower of High Sorcery in Palanthas when Palin and Steel first meet Usha. Until that moment, every man that sees Usha is completely incapacitated by her beauty. Steel barely glances at her. In fact, there's no mention in either Kitiara's Son or Dragons of Summer Flame of Steel having a romantic interest in any woman. I guess you could argue that he's simply not wired that way. But I like to imagine that Steel and Sub-Commander Trevelyan are secretly in love and too proud to admit how they feel. But that's just me. So what don't I like about this novel? Well, I can boil it down to two significant flaws. First, Usha. Now, I don't think she's a bad character. She's a perfectly acceptable character, but she exists out of a sense of obligation, I think. Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman had written a story called Raceland's Daughter, and now that they were assembling the Children of the Companions into a single Avenger-style crossover, that story needed to pay off somehow. Raceland's Daughter needed to be a character in the novel. But there was a problem. The book needed a love story, too, and the only single heterosexual humans available were Palin and Usha. That put the authors in a quandary. Either they had to write a story about two cousins falling in love, or Usha had to be fake. Obviously, they chose the latter. It's deeply unsatisfying because Usha is deliberately set up to fool the reader into thinking she is Raceland's daughter. She's the right age, she has gold eyes, she has white hair, and she was raised by the Irda, which is what Raceland's baby mama was, according to the legend. It even explains why she's so ugly to the Irda, she's half human, and so beautiful to everyone else, she's half Irda. But no, it was all just a big coincidence. And then there's Usha's diminishing importance after the first act. She is important as a bridge between the Irda world and the human reader, and as a message bearer. But after that, she is kind of demoted to simply being Palin's love interest. She has a few hero moments of her own, but those hero moments could have been anyone's. Tasselhoff could have been the one to retrieve the Grey Gem. Palin could have been the one to close the Grey Gem. Usha didn't need to be there at all. If she had disappeared after delivering the letter to Dalimar, the story wouldn't have missed a beat. My last criticism of Dragons of Summer Flame has to do with the final battle. About 10 chapters are dedicated to setting up the final confrontation. Steel surviving the attack on the High Clair's Tower and organizing the remaining knights, Usha retrieving the pieces of the Grey Gem, and Palin acquiring the Spellbook of Magius. They are all ready to do their part when they meet up in the Abyss. What should have happened is clear. Palin uses his light spell to blind Chaos. Steel wounds Chaos enough to make him bleed, but dies doing so. And Usha catches the blood in the Gray Gem and traps Chaos once again. A satisfying, organic ending. Instead, the drop of blood that Steel gave his life to obtain gets soaked into the dirt. Palin's spell fails, and Chaos is essentially unharmed. In the end, it's Tasselhoff who gives up his life to defeat Chaos. Palin's spell, Steel's death, Usha's trying to catch the blood, none of it mattered. Tasselhoff got in a lucky shot at just the right moment, and that's what saved the day. I get it, though. They wanted to end the novel with the heroic sacrifice of a beloved character, and they'd already killed off Tanis, but it feels anticlimactic after all the excitement leading up to it. But these complaints don't really ruin the novel for me. They're just minor complaints, not deal breakers. It's still one of my favorite Dragonlance novels. So that's all for today. Chaos has been defeated, and Kryn is now a godless, magicless world just like our own. And so we too must leave Kryn for a new world, the demiplane of dread. Our next episode will be our first Ravenloft novel, Vampire of the Mists by Christy Golden. But don't feel too sad. We'll be returning to Kryn eventually, although we might not like what we find. If you enjoyed this episode and want to support the podcast, please visit patreon.com/dndbookclub. That's D-A-N-D-D book club, where you can see a list of the bonus episodes available without any commitment. Access to those bonus episodes is just $5 a month, so please consider supporting the podcast. If you have any comments or questions, you can reach me at dndbookclub@gmail.com, or you can follow me on Instagram at dndbookclub. Thank you for listening, and until next time, remember, there's never a right time to tell your boyfriend you are lying to him about being cousins, but he probably won't be as mad as you think.